This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Dr. Steve Albrecht, who manages a San Diego-based training, coaching, and management consulting firm. He's written a new book for ALA called Library Security, Better Communication, Safer Facilities. You can find him online at drstevealbrecht.com or on Twitter at Dr. Steve Albrecht. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here and happy to talk to you about library security today.
Yeah, you are retired from the San Diego Police Department and you now run your own consulting firm. What made you want to focus on libraries in your post-police career? Did you have experiences with libraries when you were a police officer?
I did, and for the usual reasons that people call the police to the library: homeless, mentally ill, drug addicts, gang members, thieves, stuff like that. So when I was working in law enforcement, I sort of saw the library as just kind of one of those places that the cops had to go to from time to time. What I discovered later in my consulting work is that there are a lot of issues that library people face and that need help. And so they came to me about 17 years ago, some library folks in California, and said, "Can you help us?" And I was kind of surprised about how bad it was. And I started my consulting practice for libraries back then.
They wrote a book called Library Security. Was there any specific reason you wanted to write it as a book or just to have a source for everybody to go to? Or
I started doing library training programs for the American Library Association in Chicago. I started doing webinars for them and doing some writing. And after about the fourth or fifth webinar, which seemed to be pretty popular and well attended, they came to me and said, "Would you write a book on library security? It's kind of an underserved subject for us." I think the last book that came out was The Black Belt Librarian, and that was probably closer to the end of the 80s, early 90s. And so I was happy to fill that gap.
Public libraries especially, I think, is what the kind of the focus of the book is. I mean, and academic libraries deal with this at some part. And anything that's open to the public deals with these kind of issues. Public libraries are obviously the most. Why is it important that we need to know how to deal with these issues? Obviously, we can't just call the police every single time anything goes wrong.
Yeah, and one of the things also from your list besides public libraries is also law libraries. And I had kind of an introduction to law library security concerns. And that's a very unique environment. You get folks coming in there that are kind of entitled and angry and upset. They want free legal advice, which certainly the law library people cannot give them. They're frustrated about the forms, and they're always seeming to want to sue the government or sue the city or sue the county. So that was another environment as well besides, you know, university and college libraries too. And you're right. I mean, you can't call the cops every time. And what I've found in my experience with library people in general, and I know this from my own personality, is that they tend to be kind of introverted and they're put into a role where they're expected to be extroverted. So what I try to teach in my programs and in the book is to how to be a little bit more assertive and to work as a team and to address some of these concerns before they become a police issue.
And what do you see as, I know in your book you have some role-playing scenarios. Do you think that's one of the better ways to do training on this kind of thing?
You know, as a guy that goes to training programs as well, I find the role-play experience sometimes to be kind of tedious in the workshop. And so I usually do it at the end when the group is a little bit more warmed up and they have a little bit more connection with each other. Most of the time my clients are libraries that everybody knows everybody. Sometimes I do public forums for libraries across the state. But I like the role-play just to kind of put them in large groups, 5 to 7 to 8 people, and walk around and watch what they do and look at the interaction. But I think sometimes, you know, we get kind of standard conversational patterns that we use in situations where we're dealing with high risk or angry or threatening people. And I like to watch those in action and see how they do.
And you talk about, and I've read other things recently about this, and so I'm kind of interested in the Q-tip thing of quit taking it personally. Why is that important in dealing with a security issue?
Yeah, I kind of stole that from my colleagues that teach customer service, and it was mentioned in an interview that I did with a library journal in the October 2015, a library journal. They talked about this Q-tip, which is quit taking it personally. And that sounds easy to do from here where you and I sit, but sometimes we get caught up in feeling the emotions of a conflict with a library patron where they insult us or, You know, they say the usual things like, I pay your salary and you're here to serve me. And, you know, how dare you ask me to conform to the policies and procedures? And I think sometimes it's easy to get caught up in taking it personally and feeling like they're attacking you. And you know this from your experience. They're not angry at you specifically. They're angry at the situation, or they're embarrassed, or sometimes we've caught them in a situation where they kind of feel like they don't know what the answers are, and so they lash back. And I think, you know, if you can't separate yourself from taking it personally, it's easy sometimes to get caught up in the adrenaline and get a little more angry.
Right. I feel like a lot of times they're upset about something else maybe, and then you're the one that's that 40-cent fine or whatever is what kind of is the camel that it's a straw that broke their back. It wasn't you specifically maybe that made them angry in the first place even, but you still have to deal with it. So
yeah, I see that, and what sometimes happens is there's a sense that, you know, they don't care what your job title is or how long you've been there or what, you know, what your work effort is for them on behalf of them. They don't care about it. They're trapped in their own little world. Sometimes they see the ocean through their little drinking straw. There's a sense of entitlement sometimes. And as a result, they take it out on people. And I always say, you know, it's useful if you can, and it takes practice and it takes some skill to sort of see yourself as standing in an observing mode, watching the transaction, watching the interaction, instead of being caught up in the actual. And sometimes it's easier to have a little bit of professional distance and look and say, it's just another conversation. They're going to go on their way. I'm going to go my way. I do the best I can to keep them as satisfied as possible, knowing that I can't make everybody happy. But I think sometimes library folks beat themselves up for not having a perfect answer to every single situation.
Right. And do you have any other specific ways of people that can deal with that stress and anger management kind of stuff? I know you mentioned in your book about managing your breathing and things like that. Do you have anything else like that? Advice?
You know, there's kind of an interesting parallel to managing anger and difficult conversations. I seem to have taken on the mantle as being a road rage expert. I've done a lot of interviews and discussions and writing about road rage, and some of the same type of qualities that we get in road rage situations, like you mentioned, breathing and stress management and not taking things personally, is kind of crosses over to our encounters with difficult people. And I think, you know, oftentimes we look at in the library world is you have to have the perfect answer. I think what is more realistic is sometimes I have to find the better person than me to have the conversation. I'm a big fan of this idea of alignment. Sometimes we align with certain library patrons pretty well. It could be based on age or race or gender. Other times we align not so well, and they don't like talking to us. They'd rather talk to a colleague. So if you have a sense of connection with that person, then deal with them. If you don't, then get somebody else to deal with them. And I like trading off and sort of finding the right person or the right solution for the issue, because we're not always a good connection with everybody. I think sometimes, you know, library professionals see themselves as information providers where they always have to have the perfect answer. And I say sometimes maybe your colleague just has a better rapport, better connection with this person. Let them deal with it. Go on your break or go do something else. And then kind of related to that, I think library people get caught up in, I have to have this ongoing conversation with the patron, which could go on back and forth, you know, kind of like the tennis match, back over the net, instead of saying, I've done all I can for you, sir. Ma'am, I can't help anymore today. I've got to move on to another person to help. And I like to set boundaries. Like, you know, I give them three answers. If they don't like the third one, then I'm going to have to wrap up the conversation. Because sometimes you can feel guilty for not doing enough.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times people don't want to get to the point. They feel like they failed if they have to get to the point where they have to call in the police or somebody like that, or even a security officer if you happen to have a security officer. But I think sometimes people just get to a point where you just can't deal with them and you need somebody that's higher trained.
I think kind of a parallel to that, too, is sometimes I see library folks default too quickly to get their supervisor. So, yeah, you know, yeah. The patron gives you a little bit of grief, a little bit of gas about something, and you go, well, do you want to get my boss? Do you want me to get my supervisor for you? And then they dash off and go find the supervisor, who comes over sort of cold to the conversation, can't figure out what's going on, and has to kind of dive in. I'm saying, you know, in an environment where you're working, practice your conversation skills until it's not working for you, until it's clear that what you're saying doesn't work, and then maybe make that offer about getting the supervisor. Because, you know, if the default is, let me always go get my supervisor, you know, kind of run to mom and dad all the time, then you're not taking ownership of what you need to do, and it sort of puts the supervisor on their back foot as well.
It almost feels like that can also put the patron, the customer, they can put them on edge too, because all of a sudden they know that they're being escalated to, oh, this person had to get their boss to deal with me, so I must be doing something that they're not able to deal with.
Or the kind of the negative of that same thing, which you talked about, which is now they feel superior to the library employee because I'm gonna speak to a boss as somebody who's important and, you know, an imperial and kingly and queenly like me, as opposed to just having somebody handle it at whatever level. And so,
you know,
from your experience, and lots of library folks know that some people just like to argue. They like the conflict. They do it at the bank and the restaurant and at the gas station. They do it everywhere, and they just like to engage. And those kinds of people can be very draining.
Yes, definitely. You also talk a lot about self-protection, that you can't really keep the other people in the library safe if you're not keeping yourself safe. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think it's admirable that library employees like to want to protect the kids and the patrons and the older folks and things like that. Certainly very admirable and certainly necessary. But I always say you can't take care of other people if you're not safe yourself. And so I see people put themselves in situations where they go over to a group of teenagers and get in a big argument, or they go over to two guys that are getting ready to fight and try to break it up and things like that, which sometimes sort of feels like their job description. But what I'm saying is you got to protect yourself first, your coworker second, then the patrons third. That's the order. Take care of yourself first, your coworker second, the patrons third. It's admirable to want to be in, you know, the savior for everybody, but sometimes you got to look and say, I'm the most important person. If I can't keep myself safe, you know, I'm not useful to everybody else. It's sort of like the parallel we used to have in law enforcement, which is if the cops get in a car accident on the way to the problem, then they can't be useful. And as, you know, one of my colleagues said, if the lifeguards start drowning, we have a problem. And so the issue of taking care of yourself first and your coworker second is really, you know, where we need to think about intuition and making good choices and saying, sometimes I need to disengage and go to a safe place and break off contact completely and watch from a distance, be a professional witness, and get ready to call the police.
And I think some of the ways that we can help get over that initial, you know, because like you said, we do have the inclination to, oh, I must protect the patrons and everything first. But I think documenting things a lot of times can help us get past that, of having a code of conduct, having incident reports, things like that, things you can refer back to and sort of train yourself on ahead of time.
You're really bringing up two great points. One is documentation, or, you know, anything that we would call a security incident report, or something that you have a formalized way of capturing who said what and where and when. This could be for anything from fights or conflicts or cursing or, you know, inappropriate sexual behavior from a patron, inappropriate internet behavior or contact with children or staff, that type of thing. But then the shift over to that, not only from the documentation, but helps us figure out what to do. And we always say, if we can't measure it, we don't know what to do. So good security incident reports can help us figure out what to do. Do we see a trend? Is this patron becoming sort of the, you know, the bad boy of the facility? Is there kind of a connection to other people that we need to look at? And if we're going to talk about things like restraining orders and kicking people out of the library, city attorney, county council, they want to see the documentation.
Have recommendations for how libraries can work better with their local police departments?
You know, that's a great question. And I really feel sometimes quite discouraged when I talk to library folks. I was just in three libraries in Northern California last week doing a security assessment. And they said, we never see the cops. We never see the sheriff's department. I said, why not? And they said, well, they come if we call them, but there's not a sense that they ever come by and just say hello and, you know, come and get a cup of coffee and just kind of walk through the stacks. So I always talk about, and I mentioned this in the book 1,000 times, in my perfect library world, you'd call the watch commander for your sheriff's department or PD and say, who is the person, the deputy, the officer that has my facility as part of his or her area of responsibility? And as such, can I get this person to come over here, introduce themselves, you know, and kind of walk through the facility and talk about some of the challenges we face? Maybe it's homeless, maybe it's gang members, maybe it's theft, maybe it's abandoned kids, maybe it's adult protective services issues with abandoned elderly folks. I mean, there's lots of things where the police may be interested, but I don't think the average street cop cares much about the library. And until we can sort of insert ourselves into their world and say, hey, come through on an episodic or occasional or random basis, just say hi, kind of look around everywhere, check out the bathroom, say hi to the staff, and kind of create that sense of visibility with the patrons. You know, some of them are going to feel glad that you're there, and the problematic ones might think, you know, maybe I'll go somewhere else and pester somebody else.
Yeah, because like you said, they may not understand what's going on in our buildings, just like we don't understand exactly what they're doing. So it's good for us to learn each other. So,
Yeah, I get a sense that sometimes people think they're bothering the police, and I get it. I talk to cops. I've been around cops 31 years, and they're so, you know, we're shorthanded and we're busy and there's lots of radio calls. I'm like, I get all that. You know, I mean, there's also a lot of downtime in law enforcement where they drive around, you know, looking out the window. And I think if they can make certain areas of responsibility their projects, right, come in, check on the library, come in, check on the other city and county buildings. Don't wait to be called. Be vigilant, be proactive. Catch some of the bad guys when they're in there getting ready to do bad things and interrupt that opportunity.
Yeah, it seems like being proactive is a good way of sort of stopping things before they start. And that's the best way to deal with situations.
I often find library folks are like me. They're introverted, and they thought the job was about books and periodicals and great literature and that type of stuff, and I'll have plenty of time to read. And as you well know, it's about people. And sometimes it's about eccentric people doing eccentric things inside your facility. And so boundaries and codes of conduct, and that was another great point you brought up, the idea of code of conduct. In my perfect library world, you'd be able to see it from outer space. It would be visible on the walls. It's not something that's on a clipboard behind the circulation desk. There's a sense of kind of action to the code of conduct. And also, I like codes of conduct where the language is positive. Please enjoy your food and beverage outside is better than don't eat in the library. But a lot of stuff has kind of a negative, legalistic sort of a tone to it, and it sort of puts people off when they look at it. If it's more positive, please enjoy your phone calls, you know, or take your phone call outside, as opposed to no cell phones in the library, just kind of switching the language around to A, kind of plain English, and B, not so legalistic, can set a tone which is much more sort of collective rather than being, you know, the rule makers.
And do you think they should be fairly simple and short as well, so people can actually, because I feel like sometimes you go to some places and you see a code of conduct and you see just a block of text, and it's like people are just going to walk right past that.
Exactly. And you look and you say, we have, you know, 19 rules and they're all, you know, a paragraph long. Nobody reads that stuff. I mean, short and snappy, plain English, easy for kids to understand, easy for adults to understand. I mean, you know, the sign next to the tax forms that says, you know, no tax advice is pretty easy to understand. I mean, if we make stuff more complicated, then people start to argue about, you know, whether or not it applies to them.
And do you think we need to make it more clear what the consequences are when people break the rules? I mean, like, should that be posted somewhere, or is that just sort of something that should come up as incidents occur?
Yeah, I guess it's the second one is we want to create an environment where people understand what the rules are, but I think we have a lot of choices in library world about what to do. One of the things I see that works really well, and it always baffles me that it does, is the verbal restraining order. So I'll see some homeless guy, and what will happen is he'll get kicked out, and the way they kick him out is they'll say, okay, Pete, you know, you can't come in for 10 days. You're banned from the library for 10 days, and we'll tell you when the time's up, and it's 10 days from right now. And so he leaves, and then, you know, about day four, he's like, 6 more days, right? And they're like, yep, 6 more. Okay, 3 more days before I can come to the library. It amazes me how that works, but it does. So they'll stand outside the facility, and at the end of 10 days, they'll come back in, and they'll be pretty compliant. They'll be better, and they'll understand that there are consequences for their behavior. And my thing always is, and I've said this in the book, is if there are no consequences for the patron's behavior, it's either going to continue or escalate. And sometimes creative things like the verbal restraining order can create that sense of, we have control over this place. We're the shepherds of these buildings. We have the right to create an environment where people feel safe here, and we'll use some creative ways, not necessarily the cops or the city attorney or, you know, the rule book or the law book, but just some creative ways that the staff says, here's how we typically handle folks that do these types of things on a regular basis.
So internally, we might have like steps of consequences of what will happen after first offense, second offense, third offense, but that doesn't really need to necessarily go to the patrons themselves until they encounter them, I guess.
Yeah, I think the thing there is consistency of message. And so we're treating people, you know, the same all the way through, firm, fair, consistent, and assertive. Doesn't matter what your age or race or gender, we treat everybody the same, firm, fair, consistent, and assertive. And we have an environment which is really driven by one critical factor. What's the impact on the business? I get this question all the time in my workshops. When do we get involved in some situation? And I go, does it hurt the business or not? The homeless guy sleeping in the corner, not bugging anybody, leave him alone. He's over there panhandling or being aggressive or, you know, making a mess. You got to address it. It hurts the business. You got to address it. If it doesn't, let it go. Because otherwise, as you know from your experience, you can drive yourself and the other staff members crazy by kind of trying to create the perfect environment. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, and you talk a little bit also in the book about needing to have acting skills, and I think that applies sort of to the – it kind of ties into the Q-tip kind of thing of when you can't help but take it personally, and when you're starting to get upset yourself, that you have to be able to not convey that to the person.
I think the acting skills really kicks in at the end of the day, end of your shift. You know, you're tired, you want to go home, your feet hurt. And that's the time you really have to be careful about condescension and being abrupt and being short with folks and being dismissive. And, you know, we have a lot of energy at 9 o'clock in the morning, maybe not so much at 6 o'clock at night. So that kind of acting skills, I sometimes say, you know, it's like being on stage. When you're back in the back in the staff room, having your lunch or having a cup of coffee or chatting with colleagues or doing your work at your desk, that's one kind of environment. When you're out in front of these other folks in public, they look at you all the time. It's like being an actor or an actress in a play. You got to act.
And you write also a little bit about, I think we've covered this under a couple of other answers here, but about making sure that you work smart. Can you talk about working smarter?
Yeah, I mean, the issue there is sometimes you say, I need to get my boss or a coworker who has more expertise. I need to move this person over to a quieter place, to the library, to have the conversation. I need to shift this person over to another internet screen. I need to do different things to solve this person's issue in a way that's smart, instead of sort of being lockstep in, this is what we always do, or this is what our typical policy is. I mean, you've seen it in your career, you know, discretion and flexibility. You know, the guy owes $5 in fines. He wants to check out some books. He's only got $2. Collect the $2 and check out his books, and everybody's happy. And that kind of working smart keeps the emotional temperature down. It suggests that you're being an advocate for the patron. It lowers the possibility of conflict. It just makes for a better day.
And can you give some advice maybe on, I know it'll differ obviously with each situation, but how do you know when it's kind of crossed the line where you need to call the police, when it's just, that's the only option left?
You know, I talk a lot to female library employees about the power of intuition. And oftentimes they say to me, you know, I said to myself, I wonder if I should call the cops. And then I sort of struggled over what the answer was. And I said, what'd your intuition tell you? And they said, call the cops. And I said, then go call the cops. I use code words in my training classes. We talk about Mr. Blue or Dr. Blue, or, you know, if the sheriffs wear green pants like they do in California, it's Mr. Green or Dr. Green. Go to a safe place and call for help. The idea of waiting for bad situations to get worse is very counterintuitive. I reflect back on a couple books. One is The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. DeBecker is the security guard, everybody who's famous or important in Hollywood. He talks a lot about intuition. And then there was a profiler for the FBI named Mary Ellen O'Toole, and she wrote a book on intuition as well, which a lot of women, you know, like a lot, because it revalidates what they think, which is, I wonder if I should get my boss. I wonder if I should get behind the counter instead of stand out here. I wonder if I should call the cops. That answer is driven oftentimes by their intuition. And, you know, the idea that the cops need to come and make an arrest is not what they do. What they do is show up and lower the emotional temperature. They get people separated. They enforce consequences, and they make it possible for people to say, look, if you do stuff which is going to hurt the business of our library and put patrons at risk, we're going to take a step.
Are there people in the community that you think the library and the police can kind of work together? Because it seems like we're all working together to create a nice, safe community. Does that help to bring other people in as well throughout the community?
That's a great question. I think the biggest issue that I see library people face is homeless people that are also mentally ill, and homeless people that are mentally ill that sometimes have substance abuse issues, sort of what I call the triangle of bad behavior. Homelessness, you know, it's not bad behavior on its face, but aggressive behavior as a result of that, sort of stealing and bothering other people. Substance abuse, you know, typically alcohol and stimulant drug abuse, and then also untreated mental illness is a big concern. And sometimes the police are not the best answer for that. And I'm always talking about it. I did in the book a lot about how we partner with public and private sector agencies inside the homeless world, which is, you know, social services by the county or behavioral health by the county. You know, in my police department in San Diego, we have a homeless outreach team, or what's called a HOT team. Those folks could be useful. But also, you know, Salvation Army and St. Vincent de Paul and Catholic Charities and all these groups that sometimes have homeless advocacy. They run the shelters. They run the food banks and the programs and things like that. Bring those people to the table and say, let's sit down in a meeting with library leadership and start to come up with some solutions. What I oftentimes hear from the library folks is, well, we tried, but they didn't come to the meeting, or we had one great meeting and then it died off after that. I think you got to be the squeaky wheel in those situations and continue to try to bring those people to the table.
And one of the big issues that we deal with in libraries now, especially public libraries, and it's just going to keep escalating this way, is internet infractions, people breaking our, a lot of libraries have internet safety codes as well. How do you recommend staff deal with those kind of people if they're viewing inappropriate content or something like that? How do you intervene in that kind of issue?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I see the same escalation. And I think it's challenging because, you know, there's some libraries I go to, they have strict filtering. They use privacy screens. They have separation dividers between the library stations for the internet. Other libraries, the sky's the limit. You can bring up whatever you want. And, you know, one of the answers I have, and it seems sort of stupid on its face, but I oftentimes just flip the screen around. Many times I go to the library facility for a security assessment or for training, and I will see that the screens face out towards the open area. And then, you know, sometimes the patrons will sit facing the wall and the screens flip out the other direction. I just turn the screens around or flip the desk around and put them with their back to the wall, and they can look at whatever they want. It doesn't bother other people. It doesn't sort of leak out onto the open area, and little kids don't see it, that type of thing. Sometimes the most elegant solution is the simple one. But I think what libraries are facing, and you're probably seeing this too, is, you know, people bringing in their personal tablets and cell phones, people bringing in thumb drives and trying to introduce inappropriate, you know, virus material into the systems. And there's really got to have a lot of vigilance about that process. And I think, you know, if we go back to the homeless outreach people helping the library people, then I would say reach out to IT. You know, your county and city IT professionals can come in and give us some advice about better software, better protocols, better Wi-Fi systems and things like that, that they can protect more effectively. And, you know, the library folks sometimes have a lot of information about that, but the IT people are supposed to be, you know, Johnny on the spot, state-of-the-art knowledge about what we're supposed to be trying to protect and how to do it.
The internet stuff gets tricky because, yeah, like you said, sometimes there's, on one hand, there's First Amendment stuff. On the other side, there's filtering things that are required by law, and there are local and federal law. So there's always competing issues there. But I think most libraries go along with the community standards kind of thing of what would the community want to have in the library.
I mean, I'm a pretty libertarian guy in a lot of issues, and I think, you know, people have the right to educate themselves how they want to. But again, we go back to how they hurt the business. And so a guy's bringing up pornography and he shows it to little kids or, you know, moms walking by with strollers, that's clearly inappropriate. People that are watching videos that bug other people because they don't have headphones on, those are the kind of code of conduct things. You go, you know, look at your videos on our machine or on your own tablet, but, you know, you got to wear your headphones. And that kind of, again, back to firm, fair, consistent, and assertive, where you say, we set standards here that match what, like you said, either the law or the community wants to do, but it's consistent.
And one of the big things I always hear from libraries, and nobody's ever sure how to deal with it, is when there's probably a patron or something that has an unpleasant smell. Do you deal with that in a code of conduct, or like how do you deal with, because that is sort of, you know, it's disrupting the business if it's bad enough. I think it's more so maybe in places with larger homeless populations, but obviously it happens anytime. And I think a lot of people are not sure how to deal with that.
Yeah, you're right. The hygiene issue is a big concern. I actually, in the book, there's a script about hygiene conversations, and it kind of addresses four or five areas. One could be mental health reasons for hygiene problems. Another could be depression, could be medical issues, which is sometimes people have a medical concern that leads to hygiene problems. Sometimes it's a religious freedom kind of a thing. Other time, they just like bugging people with their odor. And, you know, what I've typically seen, and I've had those conversations, and they're not easy. What I've typically seen is a library supervisor will come and say, look, I need to have a conversation with you, Mr. Patron. You got to come in clean. You got to come in with clean clothes. And, you know, I'm not here to embarrass you or, you know, insult you or dive into your personal life. But, you know, when you come in and you have a strong smell, it hurts our business, and we just can't have it. And I think the other part related to that is, if we're talking about homeless population or mentally ill population, we got to have a solution in our back pocket as to what it is. Here's a bus pass to the shelter. Here's a bus pass to the place where, you know, we have day showers or whatever it is in your community that oftentimes can exist, where these folks can get cleaned up. And you know, here's some information on how to catch the bus over to the, you know, Salvation Army or whatever it is. Because if we don't give them a solution, they just leave, and then the problem doesn't really get fixed. Sometimes it's mental illness. Sometimes it's depression. Sometimes it's just free will. But it does impact the business. And the hard part, and you know this, is if we don't hear about what hurts the business because people don't tell us. They just don't come back to the library. So right. The mom that comes in with her kids and says, you know, I'm accosted by homeless guys, or there are stinky homeless guys pestering me for money or saying rude things to me, I'm just not going to go to this branch ever again. And maybe they tell somebody that can hear about it and, you know, social media, or, and it gets back to the library, but oftentimes they don't. And we don't know we've lost a patron.
And that's why it's, again, important for us to be proactive and notice these things happening in our libraries in the first place so we can deal with them.
I mean, the hygiene conversation is a tough one. You know, one of the things I also see is the homeless sort of, a large group of homeless cats that come in, and there'll be four, five, six people, and they have all these bags and bags of stuff, and they don't want to leave them outside because they'll get stolen. And so they come in, they sort of set up camp, and they're kind of hanging out for 8 and 10 hours a day, and people don't want to go to that part of the library, and the staff feels a little uncomfortable. And they just sit in there and sort of BS and hang out and make a mess, block the aisles with fire, you know, code stuff, and leave their stuff laying around. And what I think has to happen is somebody at a leadership level has to say, enough. You have the right to use this place safely, but when you're not, I'm going to come over and address this. And what I try to tell them is, look, find the smartest of the folks that's sitting over there and say, you know, who speaks for this group, or which one of you was, you know, going to come talk to me, because I got to tell you some stuff that you guys need to do differently. And then try to have a rational conversation with the guy and say, look, either you folks use our facility safely, or I'm calling in the cops, and guess what they're going to do? They're going to impound you, or they're going to impound your stuff. They're going to test you for sobriety. It's not going to be fun. Or warrants, right? So you don't want those guys to come in here and sweep you out of here. I'm asking you to comply. Use this place in a way that doesn't put other people at a sense where you're taking over our library.
Well, and I want to wrap up with something that I think ties into those last two answers that you had. Like, one of them you said, pull the person aside and don't embarrass them. Because I think de-escalating a situation can be really important. Do you have suggestions for how people can de-escalate a situation when someone's gotten angry in the first place, so whether it's gotten to a lower staff member or if it's gotten to a supervisor? How can we bring it down so that maybe we don't have to call the police?
I just mentioned this in a webinar that I just did for library folks, and it always drives me crazy when I hear library people tell folks they are not calm to calm down. You need to calm down, sir, right? That just never works. In the history of mankind, it's never worked. So lowering your tone, letting people vent a little bit, validating their concerns. I understand. I'm sorry that happened. Tell me more about the situation. Let me jot a couple notes here. Those are very validating statements. That type of stuff can take control of the conversation back over to you, where you're listening with you know, actively. You've got some empathy. You're asking questions. You paraphrase. You're looking for solutions. I think that's the best we can do for the variety of folks that we have to deal with.
All right. Well, Steve, can you tell people how they can find out more about you and your consulting online?
Yeah, I'm happy to do so. I have a website. It's Dr. Steve Albrecht. That's D-R and then Steve and then my last name, which is Albrecht, A-L-B, like Bravo, R-E-C-H-T, like Tom.com. ALA's got my book over there, Library Security, Safer Facilities, Better Communication. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Steve Albrecht. I talked to a lot of folks from the library on Twitter. I'm happy to do that. And thanks a lot, Steve.
All right. Thanks for being on the show. Bye.
Take care.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Music is by Pamela Klicka. If you'd like to learn more about the show, listen to past episodes, or read transcripts, visit circulatingideas.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas, like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas, or drop me an email at mail@circulatingideas.com. If you'd like to support the show, visit patreon.com/circideas. And please rate, review, and recommend the show on iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice to help others find the show. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.